We are back. The natural resources 7A.
Oh, we're not
going to
do the urgency item, please.
Well, we get people on.
Oh, okay. Well, I just...
Well, he needs to be educated as to what we do, right?
Correct.
All ears.
Oh. Anyway, we got consultants online. I thought we'd get through this quick.
Thank you.
Mr. Parker.
Sorry to have to jump in. Good morning.
Yeah.
Matt Parker, Natural Resources. This item, we are going to have a technical update from the Tule Lake GSA consultants regarding their SGMA efforts. A quick reminder with the Tule Lake SGMA process is it's a four-team board member, Siskiyou County, Modoc County, City of Tule Lake, and the Tule Lake Irrigation District. I sit as a representative for the county and have been attending all their meetings, weighing in as necessary, etc. And so they are at the point to start providing the various boards an update on their work. And so today we have Angela as a representative for MBK Engineers that has been leading the technical work and developing the plans for Tule Lake. So I will I'll turn it over to her once we're all set up.
What's Angela?
Angela.
There she is.
Angela, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. All right, good morning. My name's Angela Bazzoni, as Matt mentioned, and I work with MBK Engineers. We are the consultant for the Tule Lake Subbasin Groundwater Sustainability Planning effort. And I do have a few slides that we'll walk through, so if you could move down to the next slide. Perfect. So today I'm just going to do kind of a brief introduction that will cover the location of the subbasin as well as the four groundwater sustainability agencies that Matt mentioned, the groundwater sustainability plan process and timeline, and also cover the outline, which will include a description of chapters that have been released and those that we will be releasing next. Next slide. This is a map of the Tule Lake Groundwater Subbasin. It's in the northern portion of California, right along the Oregon state line. The light blue color here is the Tule Lake Irrigation District GSA. They make up the largest portion of the subbasin. Modoc County GSA is also one of the four GSAs, and they are the second largest and cover all of the white areas in their portion of the subbasin. Siskiyou County is the darker blue on the west side of the subbasin, covering the fringe areas outside of the irrigation district. And then the fourth GSA is the city of Tule Lake, which is the yellow portion in the center of the basin. So those are the four GSAs. Next slide. We are currently in the last 7 months or so of the GSP preparation process. The plan has to be submitted by January 31st, 2022. We are currently drafting the final sections of the GSP for review by the GSAs, or the Tule Lake core team, as we call them, which are made up of representatives from each of the GSAs. And then the next steps will be to release the draft GSP for public review and adoption. And there's a little more detail on the next slide about this area that's circled in the black box. So we'll move forward. Thank you. So here's that zoomed in view. Our next step is going to be to issue a formal notice to the cities and counties. That's our notice of preparation requirement, and that letter is going to be sent out to Modoc, Siskiyou counties, as well as City of Tule Lake and City of Newell, even though most of those cities and counties are participants in the process. After that, we will initiate the public review process with release of the GSP and local engagement. And there is a requirement in the California Water Code that if a city or county has comments, then the GSAs must respond to those within 30 days. So there is a component there for ongoing coordination with local entities. Following that, we will issue a final GSP for consideration by the Tule Lake core team, and that'll be done through a public process. There is a memorandum of understanding that is between the four GSAs, and that it states that the groundwater sustainability plan will be presented for adoption by the GSAs after the Tule Lake core team has approved the plan. So we anticipate that the core team will be approving the plan in November, followed by adoptions by the GSAs in either late November or early December. After which there's some reformatting that has to be done to submit the plan to the state through the portal, and that'll be submitted by January 31st, 2022. And then there is further review process by DWR and the public at that time. Okay, next slide, please. This is just a brief overview of what the GSP will include. What I am going to cover today, we've already talked briefly about the GSAs and the plan area. I'm going to dive in a little bit on the hydrogeological conceptual model, groundwater conditions, monitoring network, and water budgets. And we are still currently preparing the sustainable criteria and goals, as well as projects and management actions in the communications chapter. So I'll cover those kind of middle four on this list. Next slide. This is a geologic map of the Tule Lake subbasin. It's not the best quality because it's a rather large map normally, but the Tule Lake subbasin is generally that yellow area that's in the middle of this figure. And it's an alluvial subbasin that's surrounded by mountains to the east and west, and it's also underlain by volcanics. There's a lot of volcanic deposits in the area. The next two slides are going to show, or the next one slide is going to show the cross sections along that line that's designated with an A. Yep, so this is the east and west cross section of the subbasin. And you can see again that the yellow are those alluvial deposits, which is the main extent of the subbasin. And then the volcanics are that purple that kind of underlay the subbasin and also come to the ground surface towards the eastern and western edges. And then the next slide. This shows a similar story from north to south, with the alluvial being the main portion of the Tule Lake subbasin, and those volcanics again being exposed on the boundaries to the north and south. Okay, next slide. There are quite a few groundwater wells that are monitored within the Tule Lake subbasin. A lot of these are also used for agricultural purposes. But there are 70 wells that are currently monitored at least 2 times per year. And we are going to rely on historical data from these wells and then also continue monitoring the majority of these wells as part of the monitoring plan for this basin. Next. This one got a little fuzzy, but where each of those gray circles are with a number next to them, these have been identified as our representative groundwater monitoring wells. This is a subset of the 70 wells that were shown on the previous slide. And the purpose of these wells are to really focus in and establish the sustainability criteria at these select wells. And these were chosen due to their proximity to other wells. So there might be other wells in the area that have similar construction, and also that we are having distribution spatially as well as vertically. So these wells are screened at different depths so that we can identify what it might be going on in different aquifers within the subbasin. Next slide. These are hydrographs from 4 of those wells, and there was a decline in groundwater levels in the basin after groundwater pumping really started to increase around 2001. Since that time, the basin has kind of stabilized since about 2015, and that's really in the last 6 years of these figures. And we believe, as will be shown in the next couple of slides, that's going to continue into the future now that the basin has stabilized from this initial groundwater pumping. Next, please. This is a graph from our modeling effort, which was done by Jacobs Engineering. And this effort was to create the water budgets for the area. So the brown lines are change in storage over the last, my ears got cut off here, but from the left-hand side, that's 2000 all the way through on the right-hand side is 2018. And then these identifiers below the bars are created water year types. So for example, in this first year, that was considered a wet year. And the change in storage due to groundwater pumping was estimated at about 40,000 acre feet in that year. Whereas if you go to the next year, that VD is designated as what we're calling a very dry year. And you can see that there was additional groundwater pumping in that year due to the hydrologic conditions. And so as the years go on, when there's more rain and it's a wetter hydrologic year, then there's less groundwater pumping required. And overall, what we have seen in this time frame is shown on the black line, and that's the change in storage from that 2000 starting period through 2018, that there was a decrease in storage, and again, we're seeing that stabilized at this time. Next slide.
Before you go on, can you clarify storage? What does that mean?
Yeah, so the storage is the amount of groundwater that is estimated to be within the subbasin, and so the change in storage is something that comes out of the water budget model, and it estimates that based on, and I can explain it using this graph too, that based on these inflows that are shown above the zero line in the dark blues and the purples, and then balanced with the outflows that are shown below the zero in the browns and oranges, that's the overall impact to the groundwater subbasin at that time. So a subbasin has water stored within its soils, And if your outflows or uses of that water exceed the inflows, then we would see a decrease in the storage in that year. Did that explain it?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So this is a projection, a 50-year water budget projection without climate change. We do are required to present a climate change scenario as well. So this uses actual data through 2018 and then relies on that historical data and assumptions to develop a projection all the way out to 2072. And that's a requirement of the groundwater sustainability plan. And the gray line at the in the middle is the annual change in storage. So you can see that some years, based on this projection, we will have a decrease in storage, followed by other years where we anticipate wetter hydrologic conditions, we will see an increase in groundwater storage. The black line on this figure is the cumulative change in storage over the time period, so adding up those annual values all the way through 2070. So there's one thing to really point out on this figure, and that's that SGMA was initiated in 2015, and that really establishes our baseline condition. And so if you could kind of picture where the black line is in 2015, it's right around, I'd say, negative 110,000 acre feet. Our projection of that black line actually sees a slight increase, that by the end of this simulation period, we might be closer to negative 100,000 acre feet. So what that tells us is that we're not expecting substantial changes within the subbasin in our projected water budget, which is a good place to be. If you could go to the next slide. This is the same figure, but with a climate change scenario added on. Climate change in this area is anticipated to result in warmer temperatures, which will increase the amount of water needed for crops to grow. And because the majority of this subbasin is agriculture, that's really the biggest change that we anticipate seeing, is that there will be more water demand for those crops that are grown. Overall, the water budget model estimates that there will be a slightly there will be a slight decrease in the amount of storage after the 50-year planning period. I think it's at negative 105,000 acre feet, so about 5,000 acre feet less than our without climate change scenario. So overall, this tells a similar story, that we believe that we are going to stay relatively stable over this 50-year period into the future, even with climate change being considered. Next slide. We are also doing some groundwater monitoring, and I'm very sorry this does not show up clearly, but there are five red dots on this map. One on the western side of the subbasin, west of the Tule Lake sump. There's two well locations within the city of Tule Lake and two well locations around the city of Newell. And we are relying on those five groundwater wells that are currently monitored for water quality to make up our groundwater quality monitoring network. At this time, we're relying on those based on their current practices as public water suppliers and relying on the data that is collected for those purposes. Next slide. So our current chapter that we are drafting is in regard to the sustainability goal and sustainability indicators. This is all around what the Department of Water Resources has labeled undesirable results. And those include lowering of groundwater levels, seawater intrusion, reduction of storage, groundwater storage, degraded water quality, land subsidence, and surface water depletion. So we are concerned with all of those except for seawater intrusion. Obviously, this basin isn't close enough to the ocean for that to be a concern, but we are currently developing our definitions of undesirable results and how those play into the overall sustainability goal of the basin for the current beneficial uses to be continued into the future. Oh, that's fine, we can stay on this slide. So that was really all that I have for today. This is my contact information, and the first six chapters that have been released are all available on the Tule Lake Irrigation District's website at that location, along with the core team meeting agendas. We do have another core team meeting coming up next week, and they are all public meetings if anyone's interested to attend. So with that, that wraps up my presentation portion, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Supervisor Gobson.
Great presentation, but with the current drought going on and the domestic wells that are going dry, and mainly because the federal government, I'll call it refused water to the project, which is a groundwater recharge source. How are we going to account for that so that it doesn't skew the desired, or skew it to an undesirable result?
That is a great question. So as we're developing these undesirable results and sustainability criteria, we, my coworker Kyle and I met with an ad hoc committee in Tule Lake a couple of months ago, and one thing that we are factoring in is a buffer with historical lows. So we are looking at water levels that are currently slightly less than historical lows in considering our definitions of undesirable results. There's also the consideration that we might want to look back at this year because it is such a historically dry year and possibly reevaluate or redefine some components of the plan when we prepare the final version. And so that would have to be done through the adoption process and redrafting with public comments. But then we could really consider the impacts of a year like this because it is such an extreme condition.
No, well, and I'm just going to follow up on that. When you say it's an extreme condition, it's even more extreme that this is the first time the project has been declined water in its history. And that factor needs to come in because at least from this layperson's view, if they had received at least a portion of the water that they received last year, they wouldn't be facing the groundwater conditions that they have this year.
Absolutely. And as well as resulted in a considerable amount of idle land this year.
Yes.
And I think everyone in the basin is quite anxious or concerned to see the overall impacts of the lack of surface water supply and make sure that we can address that in the plan and really improve the plan because of that knowledge that we can add into there.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, thank you for the presentation. I found it very good. I know one thing that Dr. Harder talked about in Oklahoma or Texas area, they have agreements where you're looking at is you have sustainability after 50 years And some basins in the west, they're hoping to keep their wells running at least for 50 years before they shut them off. So on that end, we're looking at something that's sustainable. Now for TID, the wells, TID was typically a surface water irrigation district. It wasn't, basically that's what it was. The Two Lake area was basically a surface water irrigation area. Even with the wells going full bore, it's not enough to provide a very substantial part of the water they need, and they need the surface water to even fill in the canals where they have that flow. I'll stop there. Any comments you might have?
Yeah, I think that the result of that, especially in this year, is the amount of idled land, and it's we did rely on the Bureau of Reclamation's current projections or current operations plan to develop surface water estimates in those projected modeling, projected water budgets that I shared. And one thing that we are wondering is, with a year such as this, are we going to see a new operations plan from the Bureau of Reclamation for the area? And I think that the best way we can deal with some of these questions is, as we move forward, there will be a requirement for 5-year updates, and all of this information will be put into the model again, and we can reevaluate or come up with better informed projections of surface water supply to see how that may also impact the groundwater subbasin.
Of course, yeah, the shallow wells, the domestic wells, which are more the supplied with water this year. 2015 was a wet year in the basin. I think 17 was. Maybe it was 17. I think 17 was the wet year. Anything on regards to groundwater recharge in the plan for a wet year, able to recharge the groundwater?
At this time, there's not any groundwater recharge projects that are specifically included, but a major component of, I guess, more natural recharge is that Tule Lake Irrigation District's tailwater all ends up in those sumps, and there is a large amount of seepage from the sumps. And in addition, the Irrigation District hasn't lined its canals except for one really sandy area. But that also contributes to a lot of seepage of tailwater and also irrigation water. Of course, if we see decreases in the surface water supply, then that natural or, I guess, kind of in-lieu recharge would also decrease, and there might be a need to develop more thought out and actual recharge projects in the future that are targeted for that recharge.
All right. Thank you.
Can I follow up to?
Sure.
Supervisor Chris. So my concern is that I don't want the federal government to figure out some way to use the conditions to say the project needs less water. Basically, the groundwater recharge is dependent on the project being charged. And somehow that has to be addressed in the plan, because if that goes away and the federal government's able to say they need water somewhere else and not deliver that water, it's going to complicate the whole thing.
So you're saying that the plan should really emphasize the need for the surface water in this area, not only for the irrigation of crops, but also for the other benefits it provides, including this recharge?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, historically it was a lake until they dried it out, but they still need water to recharge the system.
Yes.
So my perspective on this is that
the historic groundwater recharge from the refuge and other places in the basin have to be part of the baseline. And if it's not going to be a part of the baseline, to me, it's a 50-year projection, just like you would with climate change.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all of that.
Let me try it again. Historically, the groundwater recharge has occurred because they've diverted water to flood irrigate refuge and keep the waterfowl areas in water impoundment. If that's no longer going to be the case going forward, to me, I consider that part of the baseline. If that's going to be curtailed, it's more of an impact probably than showing your 50-year projection with climate change. There ought to be a 50-year projection without irrigation or without the water impoundments in the refuge contributing to groundwater recharge.
So at this time, the Tule Lake sumps that are in the refuge have to maintain a minimum water elevation throughout the year, and that is under a biological opinion for species that are within those sumps and within the refuge. So we don't anticipate there being a current decrease or substantial decrease in the amount of water within the sumps. Of course, if that changes and the biological opinion changes or the Bureau of Reclamation takes steps to no longer provide surface water for that purpose, then that would have to be incorporated into a future update to the modeling efforts at one of those five-year updates for the plan.
So I guess my comment's also related to Lower Klamath. Not only the Tule Lake proper part of the basin, and I hearken back to all the presentations I've seen on the basin's function prior to the engineering that was done to drain it and turn it into agriculture. That remnant piece, including Lower Klamath, I believe is a part of historically what was there in function. Until recently, Lower Klamath was flooded and there's not been much water in it at all. This year, I don't know that the same agreements apply there. I'm not that familiar with the water management of Lower Klamath. But I'd also draw attention to the fact that what I've been watching over the last 30 years is the northern side of State Line Drive or State Line Highway there. Historically, back in the 70s and 80s, also was flood irrigated, and it's rare that I ever see any water flooded on that portion of the refuge as well. Seems to me there should be quite a bit of modeled groundwater effect to the curtailment of what has historically been done as far as water management in the basin. Supervisor Chris.
And then just to confirm, the minimum lake level or the minimum water levels in the sumps is for the suckerfish, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And then this year, I know you're aware of it, this year they were pumping out of one sump into the irrigation district and then also to get water from that one sump to the other sump to keep minimum flows or a minimum level to try to deal with botulism, sadly, we'll be facing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're throwing stuff at you, too. You're focused on groundwater, that's what you can control, and then we're throwing surface water at you as well. And I recognize that's what you can. I recognize what you can control and what you have to model, but I'm sure you understand our concerns.
Oh, absolutely, and MBK Engineers is Tule Lake Irrigation District's engineer for other purposes, and currently involved with the drought response agency up there. And while I'm not really engaged in that process as much, that we absolutely recognize that this is a huge issue this year, and are very concerned about what this will look like in the future.
If nothing else, then Mr. Park, do you have anything else? All right, well, thank you.
You're welcome. And if, I'm sure Matt will coordinate if there is a need for another projection when the full plan is out, and of course when it's also brought in for adoption. So I hope to speak with you all again in the future.
Thank you. All right, at this time I'm going to move to the urgency item. And I'm going to call on Ms. Davis here in a minute. Yeah, just a little bit of history. It was brought to my attention by some Mount Shasta residents about the curtailment of the ability to cross the Azalea overpass in Mount Shasta. And I'm very familiar with that. I actually used to live on that end of Old Stage Road. My concerns when listening to this lady yesterday on the phone was that Caltrans basically going to go through their project right in the height of the fire season. If you're familiar with Old Stage Road, once you get down below the resort, should a fire compromise your egress to the north, there really is no reasonable way out of there. You're confined to either going over Azalea Overpass, or you've got to go the rugged dirt road down through Cantera Loop, which is very slow going and would be a real bottleneck. I guess my overall concern is I watch Caltrans and express my opinion here a little bit, is that we are in a period of drought not seen in this county in well over 100 years. 1924 was the last reference that I've been given. However, when I look at the fire indices these days, as I have on just about a daily basis, we're exceeding the maximums ever recorded right now for the month of August. And we haven't even begun to get into what is actually the severe part of fire season yet. My concern, I guess, in general is that those people and those entities that affect public safety, like Caltrans, seem to be doing business as usual. And I'm sorry, we're not in business as usual. And you know, my concern was heightened not only with this action, but also what's going on in Interstate 5. A horrible entrapment situation going over Ashland, the Ashland Summit right now.
Same at South Weed.
South Weed's the same way. It's been the same way down the Dunsmuir, below Dunsmuir and Castello. Highway 3 right now has the bridge torn out with Caltrans. So all these projects to me are cumulatively, if you will, putting, I think, public safety at risk. The other thing I'd like to say too is that when an agency does business, they say they coordinate. They send out an announcement, basically. Well, if you've ever been to federal court, sending out an invitation in an announcement is not coordinating, not by any stretch of what the due diligence is there. So I would encourage those agencies to reach out to the public entity that is responsible for the public safety, that being the county, and diligently work with us on the timing of some of these projects going forward, rather than, as I say, business as usual. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Davis. She's done a little bit of research on this particular thing, and I'll bring it back to the board for discussion.
Angela Davis, County Administrator. As you mentioned, there is quite a heightened sensitivity with regards to our fire situations that we've experienced and probability of re-experiencing in the future. So concerns have been raised with regards to the Azalea Overcrossing Project. I did speak with a representative from Caltrans yesterday and expressed the concerns that we are hearing from our constituents. The project has been under the process for over 4 years, and so we are here now, and the project has begun, and so Caltrans has assured that they will work very closely with us. I have scheduled a meeting with Caltrans representatives to have an in-person meeting to discuss the plan ahead with regards to any type of emergency situation. The representative assured me that Caltrans, they focus on the project, and when an emergency or an incident occurs, that they are literally directed by CHP or the Sheriff's Department. They will follow their orders exactly as they are issued by either entity. So if there were if there was, for an example, an emergency and evacuations were needed within an hour, they would do whatever the Sheriff or CHP ordered them to do in order to make that a possibility. There is a small window with this project where, now, define small window, I don't know, but hopefully I'll get a better idea of what that means, where steel will be laid and also concrete be poured to where that bridge will be impassable. And so, again, this meeting that I have scheduled, the Sheriff will be in attendance along with the Director of Public Works, our Director of Emergency Services, as well as the Director of General Services for the LTC component, to meet and discuss every single possible plan that could be put into place for any imaginable emergency or incident that would occur to ensure the safety of our constituents. That's our number one priority at this point. And so that is the Azalea overcrossing. Also, quite a bit of comments have been received with regards to the I-5 corridor projects. Yesterday, Caltrans did implement a change in their project. Originally, it was a three-lane to one-lane merge. They changed to a two-lane to a one-lane merge with the hope of saving approximately 20 minutes of the backup that was being experienced from folks traveling on the I-5 corridor. They are hopeful that that will mitigate some of the backup that is being experienced by those folks that are traveling on I-5. They are also putting together a change order for future. The I-5 corridor, of course, is staged a project, and so they're putting in a change order that will, again, hope to eliminate or mitigate even more of the delays that people are experiencing. So, with all that being said, we are in contact with Caltrans directly. I do have a meeting that we'll be meeting in person to express our concerns and also put together protocols for emergency and also discuss future communications with regards to projects that are being planned or that are upcoming so that the board will also be able to be informed as well as the public. To make sure that everyone is informed as much as we possibly can so that they can prepare accordingly to any kind of situation that they may face depending upon traveling down I-5 or in the area of the Azalea overcrossing. So with that, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I just want to add on just a little bit in that, I've heard concrete has to be poured a certain time at certain temperatures. I get it. Concrete mixes can also be changed, to accommodate that. I also know that as well. The other thing I would like to address, though, is that there is, in fire, from the standpoint of when fires are most dangerous, is it's when you get over what's called the 90th percentile. Which is, basically there's 10% left in what the recorded fire danger can be, in simple terms. That occurs before, even on drought years, before July 15th. So my point is that the project could have been accommodated after the freezing period and before July 15th, rather than after July 15th to October 1, which is historically what's called the 98th percentile, which means it is the period of time in our county for explosive fire development. And just avoiding that period would relieve a lot of my concern, I guess, from a public safety standpoint. It doesn't really relieve all of it, but it certainly lessens some of the impact that we could have should we get a fire start. Unfortunately, this project is scheduled right in that most extreme fire behavior period of the year. That's unfortunate. Rest of the board,
go ahead,
Chairman.
Supervisor Chris.
Try not to say everything you're going to say. In regards to this, thank you for taking this issue up. Just some other partners that I wanted to throw out there. You said OES and the sheriffs. I know sometimes the county, even though we don't control CHP, we work together in most crises. Will the CHP be there also?
No, this meeting is an internal county meeting only.
Oh, I see. Okay. And then in regards to coordination of these things, CHP I'm sure will be brought in, but also local fire departments, local fire chiefs, local, so they know what they need to do to bring them into the communication. Since we're dealing with a state agency, it's not to name drop, but it's good just to CC the Dallies in on it. Assemblywoman or Senator Dally, just because you're dealing with a state agency, just so they know what's going on too, so they get questions from constituents. It helps them out, it helps us out, but also helps them out with constituents, because some people call up directly to the assemblyman or the senator, and they bypass us, and then they know what we're doing. And then I can understand, I know with Caltrans, they're working someone for projects for a very long period of time. You know, 4 years ago when they were starting this, we didn't have this dry condition and those sorts of factors in place as well. So I'm not just focused on Azalea. I'm sure you're not either, but all the other projects as well. The Supervisor Chairhop brought up is a true coordination, and I'm not, this isn't meant to be callous. I'm not as worried about convenience, because we get inconvenience from road construction. The genuine concern here is safety. So I don't want staff to be roped into, well, I had to wait 10 extra minutes at a stop sign, and it caused me to be late to work. Well, then you leave 20 minutes earlier. It's not just convenience, but it's genuine focus safety evacuations, access of emergency vehicles across those parameters. That's where I'm focused on. Thanks.
So the one thing that, you know, Caltrans does not like to talk about is the impact of county roads. So Edgewood turn off all the way on North Old Stage back into Mount Shasta is being used by truck traffic, cars, because of the clogging backup traffic at South Weed Boulevard, or not, South Weed exit on I-5. And now they have the northbound on the other side and going into one lane as well. I get that they need to do the work that they need to do. I get that part. But with the fires that are occurring and an evac that may have to take place, it limits what can, it chokes off everything that can get through. So one of the things Caltrans needs to do is offset the cost of the impact to our county roads when their projects really detour. Not, they don't do it purposefully, but it's just the way it happens. That needs to be addressed. The Azalea Road thing, I'm sorry, you guys need to find and build another road for exit if you're going to shut down that bridge so that residents there, because on the direct west side of that, in that subdivision, if there was a west side fire and the Azalea is closed, there's no way for them out. There's not another road unless they cut one right to I-5 as an emergency type thing. Another area that we brought up at the Transportation Commission is South Weed Boulevard connecting to Truck Village. Because again, for fire and public safety related things, even just for our locals, it's enough that you have traffic on I-5 as the artery, but when locals are trying to get out, you can't get out right now if that traffic's backed up. So those are concerns, and they're legitimate, and Caltrans, you know, they need to deal with it. In their planning, they just need to kind of figure out, okay, if there is an emergency, what's the off-ramp? Literally, how do we fix it? So
other than that, I look forward to seeing what comes of the meeting and come back to this. And then going forward, if there's something that future projects that come up, I'd like to see, you know, we're here struggling with things in public works. I'd like to see that come to the board for a resolution that we can send either letters or a resolution to some of these entities to maybe get their attention and get them to address things.
I agree. And also, one of my favorite sayings is that we cannot fix something if we don't know it's broken. And so I do want to encourage the public as well as anyone to please give the county administration a call if they have experienced any kind of incident, or this is a very good example of, you know, where they want solutions, to please feel free to call us so that we can reach out and get to the bottom of it and then repair whatever it is that's broken to be able to move forward to make sure that we have everybody that is notified timely so that people can prepare. And so, but our main focus right now for myself is the emergency aspect, and that is making sure that we have several plans in place, walking through tabletop exercises to understand the potential of different types of emergencies and what that would look like, and plans in place to make sure that we are ready to protect our citizens. So that's the focus of this meeting that will be held.
Thank you. I turned to Supervisor Ogre and I was looking the other way. She could get my attention here.
I happened to poke you with the principal. I know that other entities have to ask permission and get permits through Caltrans to do any work when it comes to roadways and easements. And it's a little frustrating that Caltrans doesn't have to get that same permission anywhere else. So I think that line of communication needs to be open from the top down, not just from the bottom up. So it would, and it's good to open up that line of communication. I think that's really important. So I appreciate that these meetings that are gonna happen. And it would be nice to, important to emphasize that perhaps they start looking at doing work within those other boundaries of time earlier or later, and perhaps push their windows of opportunity a little more and make them work maybe just a little bit more quickly, instead of stretching out their projects over years, and or do them in phases, so that we're not putting, we're putting public safety first, so that we can make sure that our constituents are safe during these really, really important times of the year. And looking at, you know, concrete mixes a little bit differently, and trying to work a little bit more differently now that, that our environment's changing, our climate is changing, we need to do work a little bit differently. I think that's really important.
I'm going to end this with the fact that the Great Back Road is still closed. Primary evacuation route out of Happy Camp. Of course, it was frustrating the heck out of me. It's due to environmental litigation against the agency trying to remove hazard trees along the road so that they can open it safely to the public.
Can this board do something to expedite that? And I mean, actually require it be done because of public safety?
Yeah, we tried. Maybe we can have that discussion again. We sent a letter. I don't know what we can do, but I'd certainly entertain that. The other thing that I've talked to both the board supervisors on both sides and said, if you need help, legal help, with the county to stand in alongside you, reach out and work with us.
So it's passable, right?
It is passable. In fact, the governor went
over
it. When he was in Happy Camp not too long ago. However, it's closed to the public. And it is passable, I guess, in an emergency. Emergency traffic could get through unless it's blocked by contractors logging equipment, that kind of thing. So been silent on that for a couple weeks. We haven't heard anything. That it remains closed.
Okay.
So maybe we'll take that up again in the near future. With that, I'm going to look at and recognize the fact that Senator Feinstein's field representative is on the phone, Joanne Delgado. And Joanne, if you wish to speak, we could recognize you if you want to be unmuted and speak. If not, if you're just listening, that's fine too. Just let us know. Star 9 on your phone if you'd like to say something.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Good morning. My name is Joanne Delgado. I serve as Senator Feinstein's field representative covering Siskiyou County, and I've had the pleasure of meeting some of the board members in April during the cannabis tour. So with our office, we definitely are trying to do our best to be as helpful as possible when it comes to regards to that issue. And also, we have been constantly monitoring the fires that have happened in Siskiyou. So our office has been thinking so much about everyone that's been affected throughout, not just Siskiyou, but throughout the entire state. And if anyone would like to have a schedule or a meeting with me, I would be more than happy to do so. And later on, I hope to visit the fire sites in Siskiyou in the coming months, so I can always coordinate in-person meetings as well. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your involvement, and I appreciate you being on the line. Thank you very much. All right, with that, I'm going to recess Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors, convene as the Flood Control and Water Conservation District. Item 8A is public comment. Any public comment under the Flood Control and Water Conservation District? Was there any public comment?
No comment.
Okay. All right. And seeing that in-house, consent agenda.
Move to approve.
Second.
Were you the second?
I was.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Director Chris?
Aye.
Director Cobsett?
Aye.
Director Ogren?
Aye.
And Director Haupt?
Aye. MC, Mr. Barker.
Good morning, board members. I have a very quick update on our Sigma process before I turn it over to the consulting group to finalize their fee study memo. So next week is a big week for our groundwater advisory committees. We, along with our consulting team, are going to ask for a recommendation from them on the entire plan. In which we would bring to you for presentation and then in turn releasing the entire package to the public for the official 45-day public comment period, which also includes a notice of public hearing and some other steps required by us in order to move the plans forward for the official process. So look forward to the August 3rd meeting where we'll have those plans for your review. We obviously will have a summary, have our technical consultants available to provide a very high level overview of the plans, answer any questions, etc., and ask for your thumbs up to move those plans into the public process. That's the only update I have. I can answer any questions on that if you have. Okay. With that, I will turn it over to Ryan from SDI Consulting Group. He is going to provide a really quick overview of the memo that was in your materials regarding the sort of final memo of the fee study they consulted regarding what fees may look like in terms of funding for implementation of Sigma in the groundwater plan. So with that, I will turn it over to Ryan.
Thank you, Matt. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, members of the board, for having us here today. My colleague, John Bliss, is also in attendance. As Matt briefly stated, the purpose of this presentation is to give just a brief overview of the funding options outlined in our last presentation and in the funding memo. which we hope will be helpful as the board considers its path forward. And then we'd be happy to respond to any questions as well. If you can go to the next slide, we'll get started. So these are the total estimated costs that you've seen before. As you can see, Butte and Scott Valley are both between $135,000 and $230,000, with Shasta being a bit higher at about $168,000 to about $287,000. These numbers constitute the revenue goals for our tax and fee models in the memo, and they are also broken down further in the memo itself. Next slide, please. So to recap, the three funding paths to consider are self-funding, property-related fees, and special taxes. Each come with their own challenges, advantages, and disadvantages, and I will go over these paths in a little more detail here as we review the coming slides. Next one, please. So option one is self-funding. Despite the challenges involved in coming up with the funding for GSP implementation from existing revenue sources, it is worth some consideration. This way the district could avoid the hurdles, politically and otherwise, of implementing a fee or tax. And additionally, grants and loans could offset the cost of capital projects. That said, it may not be viable, and in that case, a fee or tax may be the best path forward for funding GSP implementation. And if you could go to the next slide. So option two is the property-related fee, and there are two ways a property-related fee could be implemented in this case. The first is a flat fee based on estimated usage. This does not require the metering of wells, and it is worth noting that revenue would not fluctuate with water usage. It would remain stable and consistent each year. The second is a metered usage fee, which would require the metering of wells, and revenue would then fluctuate each year with water usage. Both of these methods require mailing notices, a fee report, and a public hearing. Both also require less than 50% protest by property owners. So while less rigorous than an election, this still represents a formidable political challenge. And next slide, please. Option three is the special tax, which would require a two-thirds majority approval of registered voters, which is undoubtedly a high hurdle. Both a countywide and basin area tax should be considered. A countywide tax would result in a lower proposed tax rate as it would be spread out over more parcels. However, because the tax rates are relatively low for all tax models, the advantage of a countywide tax is somewhat diminished in this case. A few other things to consider here. The Flood Control District's Establishing Act provides a limited ability to impose a tax. For this reason, modification of the act through state level consideration and approval should be considered as it may be required. The district also would have to navigate the incorporated cities within any proposed tax area as specific permission from those cities would be required to tax within their boundaries.
Question and before
next
we go
slide.
On. Question. With regard to the incorporated cities, my understanding is that the Flood Control District is over the entire county. So how does that play out? How do the cities opt out of that?
We have had discussions with County Council, and it is my understanding that I think they would have to consent, although I will admit County Council would probably be in a better position to answer that for the specific situation, but that was the understanding that I had.
Because the boundaries of the district are the entire county.
They are, yes.
There's no cutouts, no holes that carve out anyone.
Yes, I do believe that's true. If that is the case, then maybe that is not the hurdle we thought it was. Maybe in that case, it would be not a concern.
Ms. Reed?
And the limitation on taxing within the city boundaries comes from within the specific language of the Flood District Act.
Which is, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to put you
okay.
on the spot.
Okay, I'm going to have to look
okay.
it up. I
okay.
can't recite it off my head.
Okay, because in Section 8 of what is, the Act itself, or Section 18, I'm sorry, it does provide the ability to tax, but only at 10 cents per $100, a maximum.
So we were looking at the ability to tax in zones. And so before you can tax in a zone, you have to create one of those zones. However, under the District Act, the board may not form a zone covering areas of land situated both inside and outside the corporate limits of a municipality.
But if you, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to belabor this a bit, because if the district...
My cities aren't going to opt in if there's a reason.
Well, no, where I'm headed is that we're all players in this. Water's the deal, whether it's these basins that we're dealing with or not, and the cities, to me, are going to be included in some capacity. And I'm not looking for a big tax. I'm just looking for a venue to be able to fund this, because it isn't going to work unless, to me, at least we're all players. But because the conservation district is countywide, that's where I'm getting hung up. Why would we have to have a zone when it actually gives us the ability to tax, as it says?
And
why do you have to have a zone? Just because of the different basins?
It depends. There's different avenues for taxing under the District Act. There is a tax that can apply district-wide. However, there are limitations on what the tax funds can be used for. And obviously, the Flood Control District Act was not, it was created in the 1950s and did not have this in mind. And so it limits the amount you can tax.
Right.
It limits the uses you can use those funds for. And if you say you wanted to create a zone around the GSA jurisdiction, to do that, there's even more limitations. And it really
understood. I guess where I'm going is I'm not all supportive of the zone idea, because we know that outside the boundaries of these bases, there's impacts to to those within that boundary.
Right, and then one of the complications of obviously doing a district-wide tax is you're going to pull in the Tule Lake sub-basin, mm-hmm. who already will have their own assumed fee structure.
So what's their structure up there, do we know?
They haven't discussed it from any of the meetings I've attended.
Okay. Are we actually getting, I mean, we're still just getting input on this, right? Okay.
Correct.
Yes.
The Tule Lake Irrigation District charges fees to the constituents. There's so much an acre foot, stuff like that. It's like a lot of irrigation districts do.
But even to domestic wells or something to that nature?
They don't oversee domestic wells.
No.
Yeah, that's for the irrigation district.
Right.
But their surface water, they charge great for the.
But this option three would incorporate and include everyone in the county, including domestic well users as well as irrigators.
I'll let Brian answer regarding the specifics as it relates to their study and so forth.
Yes, so the special tax would actually incorporate non-well owners as well. It would be all property owners.
So that would be a property tax on every individual parcel within the county?
Within either the county or the zones, if that were the path that you chose, yes.
And this would include, just so we know it, like the city where we could get this water from Fall Creek, it's not a well, but it would still be charged for, it's not counting the argument, just put it out there. Or the McLeod Municipal District that gets this water from a spring, but not groundwater. I don't know if I think Edna service water, Tule Lake would be, or Tule Lake, City of Doris, or groundwater.
I have two questions. Since the restrictions can't be imposed on adjudications, or mitigations or whatever we're doing. Are they also exempt from the tax?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Well, we in the Groundwater Management Act doesn't apply to the adjudication itself, like in Scott River. But can they be taxed, or are they exempt from that as well?
I'm not sure about that. John, are you on the line?
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is John Lewis. I'm also I'm a colleague of Ryan's at SCI Consulting. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk. Yeah, the way to look at the tax, the SGMA, as you probably know, with the spirit and the understanding down in Sacramento is we're going to use the fee approach. We're going to put fees on every well. We've introduced, along with some other firms, the idea of that may not be the only way to skin a cat. Let's look at a tax as well. And so if you went forward with the tax, it's a little bit separated from SGMA in that it would really rely on the flood control district itself, its taxing authority. We may need to tweak it a little bit in Sacramento, but it would, in other words, I'm giving you a long-winded answer, we believe that any adjudicated portion would still be subject to this tax, that would not exempt them from the tax. The tax would apply uniformly to either the entire county, or if you decide to go with a basin plan, it would apply uniformly to those parcels, good and bad. Parcels with big wells would be taxed the same as their next door neighbor that doesn't have a well at all. But the idea is, I think it's been articulated here today, is everyone benefits from the management of groundwater.
Okay, my next question is, I have no reasonable expectation that taxpayers in this county are gonna approve the tax. So what happens?
That's well understood, and as a reminder, we basically took advantage of available funding to get ahead of the potential fee game by having this study conducted now during our GSP development instead of 5 years from now when the county goes, we can't afford to pay staff or any of the monitoring to implement SGMA and at risk of having the water board take over. So we're basically getting ahead of the game to understand what fees may look like so we can think ahead in terms of when we get into the implementation road. We're obviously gonna be shooting for every grant funding option there is. We're also gonna be looking to partner with other entities like the RCDs, Watershed Trust, etc., on monitoring aspects to lessen the cost impact directly to the county. So that is well understood. It's been discussed in all our advisory committee meetings in terms of the reluctancy for a fee or a tax in this process. One of the top five questions we get all the time in terms of SGMA in general.
So when can I expect the well to run dry, if you will? I mean, we sit here, you know, in our advisory groups and everybody are working on all kinds of nice projects to do to ensure that we don't go further down the degradation scale in these sub-basins, but without money to complete this work, plan's not very good.
That's the balance we've been trying to play, in that a great line in an advisory committee member said during a sort of a discussion on what to monitor. He said, you know, in college, C's got degrees. So why are we trying to shoot for an A right out the gates when, you know, let's understand our basin. This was specific to Shasta, where we really don't know a lot. Let's understand our basin first before we start getting crazy about things that are going to cost the GSA money to implement. So, yes.
President Chris?
In regards to fees, that would be per sub-basin?
They looked at it in a couple of different ways, so maybe I can have Ryan or John answer that more specifically.
This is John. I'll dive in just as a reminder to everyone to give you a sense. The discussion you all are having is right on, and I agree with what Matt said about C's get degrees. The county doesn't need to be on the leading edge of this, but you do need to keep consistent with Sigma. And just to give a sense, if, and I'm not talking about domestic or where called de minimis wells, the small wells, but for the big ag wells or industrial well or utility, we're looking at each basin, the annual fee, if we just did a flat fee based on usage, no meters, meters are very unpopular, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 per well per year. So that it's a heavy lift, but it's not a deadly heavy lift. Something in that order. If we tax the whole county, it's like between $5 and $10 per parcel per year. Again, it's there's a principle doing that that folks may not want to vote yes for it, but it's not really a financial. The finances are palatable, though. I don't want to diminish them. They are palatable, just to kind of give you a sense.
Right. And that was per basin. The other two things I have, I know, Mr. Park, you probably want to get through the sustainability part per first. That takes priority. But it would be good to get feedback, because on these advisory boards, you have a representative from the city of Doris. You can speak to the city of Doris. You have ag that can give us counsel on what tax structure would be amenable or at least conflicting or. But that's down the road. You throw that out, not to throw a monkey wrench and everything, but you'll have representatives from all those entities that can represent that. Another thing I'd like to see, we talked about it at the last meeting, if we could add to it the fees, because we looked at each sub-basin, what it was going to cost to administer it. We had talked about pointing out what it would have been if the state had done it, and having that marker out there so when we have the public meetings, it shows out there, if the state had done this, this is what you would have been billed. Show people what the alternative was if the county can't. Because I brought this up last time, Mr. Parker, you're in a predicament where if you didn't do anything, people would be mad at you. If you do something, well, wait a minute, we still have to pay for this to show the alternative what would have happened.
Yeah, and I don't have those numbers in front of me in terms of what the state cost for this would have been or would be.
Yeah. But,
it's quite large.
Yeah, when we go to the public, it would let us know as well as the public know this is what you would have faced.
Well, and I think, just to follow up on that, I think the whole goal for the county taking on Sigma was to be grassroots up, customize that plan to making the county sustainable. And I'm going to just underscore, we're all players in this. It's not just those basins that we're looking at in those boundaries. It's because eventually we're going to see more come down the pipe with regard to Sigma as it expands. Let's not, the government, once it gets a hold of something, is going to expand it somewhere if they think there's more area that it wants to affect, especially in the Scott and Shasta systems. So, I'm not sure who it was that just made the indication that, even at $5 or $10 per year per parcel, to know that you would have local government overseeing Sigma versus the state of California, there should be some, I'm not a tax person, but at least there should be some comfort that it's local and that it's not getting shoved down our throats. And we're not even talking about the litigant factor of cost that could come with this as well. We've seen that when we took on Smara. So I know that in the meetings I've been at, we never indicated that this was going to be free. We indicated that there was going to be a cost associated with this as it rolled out. Grants were going to be available to as much as we could, but there was going to come a time where there was going to need constituent support. So,
all
Anything else? We done?
Did you have any more to go, Ryan?
Or... Oh, there was one more slide, just a wrap-up slide. Next steps would be for the board to consider the funding tech memo and, when ready, give direction on the desired approach. And then, of course, a more detailed funding plan will be included in the GSP, which is due, that's supposed to say, February 2022. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Again, we'd be happy to answer any other questions.
I think we're good. Thank you. Which way? Public comment. 3 minutes.
Mr. Jocelyn, it's your turn to speak.
Nick Jocelyn, Mount Shasta, California. I read the report, and this definitely shows it'll be a challenging effort to fund the monitoring network. I definitely think that option two with metering would probably be the best option. I do agree that everybody does benefit from the management of groundwater. But I also find that the largest users of the groundwater in many of these basins are ag users. And they benefit at a much greater level. So I believe they should be responsible for bearing a greater percentage of the cost. And I think if they could demonstrate that their use of the groundwater is beneficial to everybody in the basin, then that might make a special tax more palatable. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no more, I'm going to adjourn as the Flood Control Water Conservation District reconvening as the Board of Supervisors. Item 9A, the drought emergency declaration.
So moved to extend.
Extend.
Absolutely.
Mr. Kopseff, you were the second?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
I have a few seconds.
Discussion. I just want to bring up, to ask a question, I guess, or pose a question. Should we be considering an emergency declaration for the Tule Lake Basin itself, a declaration of disaster or something leading toward a FEMA declaration? I don't know what the threshold is for that, but I'm just posing the question.
Is Brian on the phone, Shinoni? I think that we don't, so far we haven't met that threshold, at least in the conversation I was on yesterday.
Angela Davis, County Administrator, you are correct. We have not yet met that threshold. But we can definitely let the board know as the status to that threshold and where we are.
I think that TID is collecting the data. OES in Siskiyou and MODOC do not have yet a lot of data on this, but TID is, and so they're in that transition of informing OES, so we see what, if we do hit that, but at this point we haven't hit it.
What's going to be difficult is because across the state lines, the Stafford Act doesn't allow you to, combine that.
I can say that the Oregon side is all over this. I mean, they're rolling out stuff as we speak. We're a little bit behind, but it's not because of our staff, it's just because we're California.
I only bring it up because I see I'm interested in a way we can elevate this to maybe the importance to the governor's office. I know he's doing some emergency energy things right now and some other emergency water use things in the rest of the state, but we don't seem to be part of that conversation.
I think what happens too is years combined together. I can't remember Ms. Davis, we've already done that drought declaration for Tule Lake. We've done it last year or the year before. We haven't done it specifically this year, have we? a one-off memory here. I apologize.
I think it had to do because Oregon had declared Klamath in it, and we, because it was in that basin, we...
That was a year or two ago, wasn't it? Okay, that was this year.
Yeah. I can definitely look into that and bring it back if that is something that
we'll do specifically because because Oregon was dry, so we were able to tack onto that to get the aid legitimately.
Okay. Beyond the human tragedies, getting to an emergency perspective as far as a disaster area, but I'm concerned too that the condition of the wildlife refuge is going to be unrecoverable.
I'll tack on. I think that the groundwater levels for even domestic wells, without being recharged, when you think about what's happening with no water charging the ditch at all, you're depleting now what is little there, so that even for next year, you're almost having to double the effort to put water in to get back to normal. And this is federally created. I don't know how else to say that. There was enough water that could have been pushed into the project that would have saved the cost of this emergency. I don't know. I've got an opinion that there's, the federal government's kind of misstepped on this deal because it's created its own disaster.
Okay, I have a motion and a second.
Super.
Aye.
Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsev, Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
And Supervisor Help?
Aye.
Thank you.
Emergency for fire. I'll make the motion to extend.
Second.
Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsev?
Aye.
Supervisor Ogren?
With the correction?
I am looking, Angela Davis, County Administrator, we are looking into the process in which we can make that grammatical change.
Aye. Supervisor Haupt.
Aye.
So what is it that needs to be changed? Do we need to bring it back?
It is within the resolution 2177 that was previously adopted. There is on the sixth, whereas on page two, there is a grammatical error where it says the Tate as opposed to the state. And so since the resolution was adopted as read, we're looking through the process of making that modification.
Thank you.
And just on another note, do we have the an updated one for marijuana, for cannabis, that will be ready before too long to come before the board? Remember we were making some changes?
We do not have that, Angela Davis, County Administrator. We do not have that modified as of today, but it should be coming. I'm anticipating the first meeting in August that all the updates should be made to that resolution.
Just wanted a little bit of an update.
Thank you.
Okay, 10A, appointments, Shasta Valley Resource Conservation District.
Yes, this is an unscheduled vacancy on the Shasta Valley Resource Conservation District. This is due to Chris Robertson's resignation. This is for a short term ending November 26, 2022. The clerk did, our process is normal for posting the vacancy as well as the district posted their the notice of vacancy within their boundaries on June 20th, 2021. At the time the agenda worksheet was created, the clerk's office had not received any letters of interest, although I've been in touch with the district, and when they have somebody interested, they will let me know. So if we could continue this, it would be great.
Okay.
Okay.
Continue.
Thank you.
All right, next. Item 11A, I'm going to open up public hearing and I'm going to continue it. What's the procedure?
It has to have a motion made for that purpose.
Okay. I'll make the motion to continue to
August 3rd.
August 3rd.
Second.
Okay. Supervisor Chris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopsev, Supervisor Ogren,
aye.
And Supervisor Haupt.
Aye.
Thank you.
We haven't done board and staff reports in a long time. I'll come back and see if there are board and staff reports.
I think we've talked about everything that I've involved. Fire water.
I just want to bring attention to the fact that Cal Fishing Game is putting a lot of pressure on the irrigators in Scott Valley as a result of the drought to come up with remedies that they see to fix some of the situations. The latest came to my attention was an effort to possibly line some of the ditches in the valley. Anybody really knows anything about the hydrology in the valley knows that the Farmer's Ditch or the Scott Valley Irrigation Ditch were lined. A lot of the wells below it would go dry, domestic wells. That's not really a good idea. And there's also study that was done 20, 30 years ago now, get my hands on the darn thing, where actually the temperature of the water in the river is lower with the diversion into the Scott Valley Irrigation District rather than leaving it in the river where it radiates and gets really hot. So anyway, just a lot of focus on things that have been tried and failed and grasping at straws kind of stuff.
So let me follow up on that through our meetings with Cal Fish and Wildlife that we have usually monthly. I think it was indicated that the department would be supportive of applying for Prop 1 money to rebuild or maintain the Upper Mountain Lakes that we've been a proponent for a very long time. That's the only answer for where the department's going to go for additional water that they need. We know that Ag is on board with dedicating that stored water for fish flows. So this is the time for the department to ask for the county's support in getting access to that funding mechanism and make it happen. How's that?
Well, along those lines, I'm glad that the senator's office is still on listening. One of the things that we'll likely need is some senatorial support because those dilapidated dams that were once in operation, and we're not talking about big dams, we're talking about 2 to 3 feet in height here, that impound water would have to be reconstructed, and the bulk of them are in wilderness. Would be commensurate historically with historical use under the Wilderness Act, but still support from Senator's office would probably be required to get beyond the political entanglements within the agencies to put it back in place. The other thing I can say, I guess, is that Fish and Game's always long on proposals to fix fish issues when most of what they propose is probably the most draconian methods that could occur. Scott Valley, in particular, anybody that knows that valley knows that river is not capable of sustaining fish life in the middle of the summer. All the vegetation's been removed. It's been removed with the Army Corps of Engineers when they straightened that river, so it is just uninhabitable for the main stem itself. The real key to protecting fish in the Scott Valley, and this isn't just me speaking, it's years of experience, managing that as well as looking at the science is to get the tribs back in a suitable condition where the fish can survive until they're in the fall rain to push them out of the ocean. A lot of that work is very easy. Just takes a backhoe. Yet the very ones that are proposing fixes on the main stem, principally the California Fish and Game, the ones that first step up and say, no, you can't do anything in a stream bed because you need a permit from us. That's unfortunate because a lot of this work is accumulation of alluvial deposits from the many rain and snow events we've had over the last 30 years that have clogged the spawning grounds and made the pools shallower in the tributaries, just deepening them would tremendously increase the survival of the salmon species in the Scott River. But, that's too easy, I guess. I guess I'm too much of a cynic. Looking forward to see that we're going to be able to fix this response.
It's called the solution.
Yeah. And there are many of them. That's it. I spoke out.
All things fire, water, cannabis, a little bit of forest resiliency, homelessness. Going to do an NCRP meeting in Eureka this week. Fire Safe Council. Busy. That's it.
Okay.
Just to touch on some big stuff, Mud Creek off of the local creek road, you guys won't be following that. It has impacted to a subdivision out there. It's fascinating to watch what nature can do. But it is a big issue as well for safety and all those sorts of things.
Is the new bridge still there?
No, I haven't seen the bridge is there, no. Yeah, because that was a big project, putting that bridge in the local creek. You know that country really well.
Yeah. Was that near McLeod?
Yeah. It is. It's near McLeod.
Yeah.
And then it cuts access to Manchester Forest Property Owners Association, a subdivision out there. They take another road, Esperanza, which is a Forest Service road, but that was their main. That's a paved road, a Pilgrim Creek road. Listened in and spoke a little bit on the Scott Shasta. The State Water Board had their meeting about minimum flows. I know you guys were visiting with the fires, so I tried to listen in on that. Wasn't planning to give a comment, but I did provide a little bit of comment. I brought up the low flow years from 1992, get very strong flows of salmon coming up, and the cohorts after that, minimum flows. More water doesn't mean more fish, not necessarily. The science backs of that. 94 was a 2 was a low water year, and then the cohorts after that on the Klamath were very strong. Montague is going to be giving their resiliency plan, the Great Northern Well, in August for the Board of Supervisors. And then also, I've been in conversations, I know we're pushing on fire stuff, offered some ideas to Chief Anzo, who's going to run by the Fire Chiefs Association, on different things we can do for the fire departments, combining their efforts, and what we need to move along. I know Butte Valley, though we're going through that process right now, is ready to combine their services together.
Okay. No further business. We're going to go to close.